emphatic slap of hands meeting backs, and the sound of cheeks being kissed as men and women embrace, laughing, crying. 2 hours later, Addie and Lovebeers stand in a serpentine line winding down the length of the island's dock. Rumors about who finally persuaded Vargas to allow the group of vagabond, visaless refugees into the country pass surreptitiously from ear to ear, although no one is brave enough to come out and ask. Best not to bring it up. Once on board, Addie and Alishka stow their valises, help Madame Lovebeer to find a seat inside, and make their way to the front of the craft. There, gripping a metal bow rail, they watch as one of the crew unloops a rope from a cleat on the dock. An engine purrs to life, and as they push off, Addie takes a last look at the tiny island that's been his home for the past 27 days. A piece of him will miss it, he realizes, as the vessel moves slowly in reverse, churning the water beneath it from indigo to white. The island, with its fragrant wildflowers and endless symphony of birdsong, had brought along with it a sense of ease. On Ilha das Flores, there was nothing for Addie to do but walk, sip yerba tea, and wait. The moment he arrives a free man in Rio, his destiny will once again lie in his own hands. He'll need to learn the language, apply for a work permit, find a place to live, a job, a way to support himself. It won't be easy. The boat completes its half-turn and fixes its bow westward, toward the continent. Addie and Alishka breathe in the salt air and lean their torsos over the shimmering sea, squinting at the granite domes of the Pau del Azúcar standing guard over Guanabara Bay. The ride is short, 15 minutes at most, but the seconds pass slowly. This is really happening, Alishka declares in awe as the vessel docks. All the waiting, the anticipation, this is where the journey ends. I can't believe it's been 7 months since we left Marseille. It's really happening, Addie echoes, pulling Alishka to him and leaning in for a kiss. Her lips are warm, and when she looks up at him, her eyes are a bright, crystalline blue. As they disembark, the refugees are ushered to a white brick customs building and ordered to wait, a nearly impossible task. 3 hours later, when their paperwork is finally complete, Addie, Alishka, and Madame Lovebeer step hastily from the customs building onto Via Elvada de Perimetral. Addie flags a taxi, and before they know it, they are speeding south toward Alishka's uncle's apartment in Ipanema. The following morning, Addie awakens, stiff from sleeping on the floor, to a tap on his shoulder. Let's explore, Alishka whispers, leaping to her feet to prepare some coffee. Addie dresses and peers through a window down at the cobblestones of Rua Rendentor and then up at the morning sky, jingling a few coins in his pocket. He's nearly broke and refuses to live off of the Lovebeer's dime. But the day is sunny and they are months overdue for a celebration. Vamos, he says. Alishka writes her mother a note, promising to return by sundown. Where to? She asks as they leave her uncle's building. Addie can tell from the way she bounces beside him how elated she is to learn about her new home. How about Copacabana, he suggests, telling himself it's okay to take part in Alishka's excitement, to share her enthusiasm about what it means to start over. Go ahead, embrace it, for her at least. Tomorrow, he can worry about a job, an apartment, about his family, and how he will go about trying to track them down now that he has made it, finally, to a city with a post office. A city where he hopes he will be allowed to stay indefinitely. Copacabana! Parfait! They walk south to the waterfront and then east along Ipanema's scalloped coastline, arriving after a few minutes at a massive, helm-shaped rock, and at the realization that neither of them knows where Copacabana is. Alishka suggests that they buy a map, but Addie points to a woman on the beach wearing what appears to be a typical Rio outfit, bathing suit, cotton tunic, and leather sandals. "Let's ask her," he says. The woman smiles at their question and then holds up two fingers, pointing at her index finger. "Aquí estamos en Ipanema," she explains. "Aproxima praia e Copacabana," she says, pointing toward a huge rock at the end of the beach. "Obrigado," Addie says, nodding to indicate he understands. "Muito bonita," he adds, sweeping an upturned palm along the coastline, and the woman smiles. Addie and Eliska skirt the rock called Arpoador, and within minutes they arrive at the south end of a long half-moon cove, a perfect confluence of golden sand and cobalt surf. "I think we've arrived," Addie says quietly. "C'est montagne," Eliska whispers. They pause for a moment, taking in a skyline dominated by peak after peak of rolling green crests. "Look, you can catch a lift up that one," Addie says, pointing to the tallest of the domes, where a cable car crawls its way toward the summit. As they walk on, the promenade, a mosaic of stones in black and white, undulates underfoot in a pattern that resembles a giant wave. Addie stares at the mosaic for a while, amazed at the work that must have gone into laying so many stones, which, up close, are surprisingly irregular in shape and orientation. It is the places where the black meets the white, the perfect edges that evoke a sense of harmony. "We are walking on art," Addie muses, glancing up at the coastline and imagining how the scene would look through the eyes of his mother, his father, his siblings. "They would love it here," he thinks. And just as quickly as this occurs to him, he is flooded with a rush of guilt. How is it that he is here, in paradise, while his family is being subjected to who knows what unfathomable horror? A shadow of melancholy passes over his face, but before it can take over, Eliska points to the beach. "Apparently we need to work on our suntans," she says, laughing about how their complexions, bronzed by their European standards, are pallid in comparison with those of the brown figures juggling soccer balls in the sand. Addie swallows, taking in the spectacle and savoring the joy in Alishka's voice. "Copacabana," he whispers. "Copacabana," Eliska croons, looking up at him, folding his cheeks into her palms and kissing him. Addie softens. Her kisses have a way of stopping time. When her lips brush his thinking mind melts away. "Thirsty?" Eliska asks. "Always," Addie nods. "I am too. Let's have a drink." They pause along the promenade at a little blue wagon selling refreshments from beneath a red umbrella reading, "Bem-vindo ao Brasil." "Coconuts," Eliska cries. "To eat or to drink?" She pantomimes the difference in hopes that the vendor will understand. The young Brazilian beneath the umbrella laughs, amused by Eliska's enthusiasm. "Para beber," he says. "Do you take francs?" Addie asks, holding up a coin. The vendor shrugs. "Beautiful. We'll take one," Addie says, and he and Eliska watch in awe as the vendor selects a coconut, lops off its top with a swift swipe of a foot-long machete, drops two straws inside, and hands it to them. "Agua de coco," he announces triumphantly. Addie smiles. "Primera vez que visita o Brasil?" the vendor asks. To the average passerby, it must appear as if they are on holiday. "Sí, primera visita," Addie says, mimicking the vendor's accent. "Bem-vindos," the vendor says, grinning. "Obrigado," Addie says. Eliska holds the coconut as Addie pays. They thank the vendor again before continuing on down the mosaic promenade. Eliska takes the first sip. "Different," she says after a moment, passing the coconut to Addie. He holds it with two hands. It's furry and heavier than he'd expected. He brings it tentatively to his nose, taking in its delicate, nutty smell, looking up again at the horizon. "You would love it here," he thinks, relaying the sentiment across the Atlantic. It is nothing like home, but you would love it. He takes a sip, savoring the strangely milky, subtly sweet, and entirely foreign taste of agua de coco on his tongue.
July 30, 1941. The Sikorsky-Mysky Agreement, a treaty between the Soviet Union and Poland, is signed in London. August 12, 1941. The Soviets grant amnesty to the surviving Polish citizens who have been detained in work camps throughout Siberia, Kazakhstan, and Soviet Asia, on the condition that they fight for the Soviets, now sided with the Allies. Thousands of Poles begin an exodus to Uzbekistan, where they are told an army is being formed under the new commander-in-chief of the reformed Polish army, also known as the Polish Second Corps, General Władysław Anders. Anders himself has been recently released from 2 years of confinement in Moscow's Lubyanka prison.
Chapter 27. Genek and Herta. Akubinsk, Kazakhstan, September 1941. They left their camp 3 weeks ago in August, almost a year exactly from when they arrived. For Genek and Herta, the journey from Altinai feels in many ways reminiscent of the one that brought them there, except this time, the top doors of their cattle cars are left open, and the ill outnumber the healthy. Two of the cars at the back have been designated sick cars, for the malaria and typhus ridden, and in 21 days, over a dozen of them have died. Genek, Herta, and Yusuf have managed to stave off sickness. They wear handkerchiefs over their mouths and noses and keep Yusuf, now 6 months old, tucked into his sling on Herta's breast for as many hours of the day as he'll tolerate. Starving and sleep-deprived, they do their best to remain optimistic. They are no longer prisoners, after all. "Where are we?" one of the exiles wonders aloud as the train slows to a stop. "The sign says Akubinsk," someone replies. "Where the hell is Akubinsk?" "Kazakhstan, I believe." "Kazakhstan," Genek whispers as he stands to peer from the cattle car at his surroundings. A land as alien to him as the luxury of a toilet, a clean shirt, a decent meal, comfortable night's sleep. The station looks like the others, nondescript, with a long wooden platform peppered with the occasional wrought iron gas-burning lantern. "Anything to see?" Herta asks. She's seated on the floor, and with Yusuf asleep in her arms, she's reluctant to move. "Not much." Genek is about to return to his spot beside Herta when something catches his eye. Leaning his head out over the car door, he blinks, and then blinks again. I'll be damned. Several meters down the platform, two uniformed men roll a cart overflowing with what appears to be freshly baked bread. It's not the bread, however, that excites him. It's the white eagle emblems embroidered on the officers' four-cornered caps. They are Polish soldiers. Poles! Herta, you have to see this! He helps Herta to her feet, and she squeezes in next to him at the door, where half a dozen others have gathered to glimpse what Genek has seen. Sure enough, there are Polish soldiers here in Akubinsk. A burst of hope in Genek's chest. Someone behind him cheers, and in an instant, the atmosphere in the train car is electric. The door is unlocked, and the exiles pile out, feeling more limber than they have in months. "One loaf per head," the two starred lieutenants call in unmistakable Polish, as swarms of bodies, bone thin, envelop their carts. A second pair of soldiers follows behind, pushing a gleaming silver urn inscribed in choppy Cyrillic letters, "Kofe." 2 years ago, Genek would have turned up his nose at the thought of sipping grain coffee. But today, he can't think of a more perfect gift. The brew is hot and sweet, and coupled with the still warm bread, he and Herta drink it down with enthusiasm. The exiles are brimming with questions. Why are you here? Is there an army camp here? Are we enlisting now? The lieutenants behind the carts shake their heads. Not here, they explain. There are camps in Vrevskoye and in Tashkent. Our job is just to feed you and to make sure you continue on your way south. The whole Polish army in the USSR is on the move. We'll reorganize in Central Asia. The exiles nod, their faces falling as the train's whistle sounds. They don't want to leave. They climb reluctantly back aboard and lean over the tracks as the train pulls away, waving furiously. One of the lieutenants throws up a two-finger Polish salute, igniting a roar amid the exiles, who return the salute en masse, their hearts racing to the clack, clack, clack of the train's wheels as it picks up speed. Genek wraps an arm around Hertha, kisses the top of Yusef's head, and beams, his spirits fueled by the sight of his sharply clad countrymen, by the coffee warming his blood, the bread in his belly, the wind on his face. The bread and coffee at Akubinsk station would prove to be the closest thing to a meal they would encounter on their journey. As they clatter on toward Uzbekistan, the exiles go days without eating. Genek and Hertha have no concept of when or where the train might stop. When it does stop, those with something to trade or a few coins in their pockets barter with the locals, who flank the tracks with baskets of delicacies in their arms, round loaves of lepioshka bread, katik yogurt, pumpkin seeds, red onions, and farther south, sweet melons, watermelons, and dried apricots. Most of the exiles, though, Genek and Hertha included, know better than to waste their time looking hungrily at the food they can't afford. Instead, when the train stops, they leap from the cars and line up for the toilet and the water tap, or a kityatok, as the Uzbeks call it, waiting as the dry, empty remains of semyechki seeds whirl about at their feet, listening intently for the hiss of steam, the first tug of the train's engine, indicating that their ride is leaving, as it often does, without warning. The moment they hear the train stir, it's a race to get back to their car, whether or not they've had a chance to use the toilet or fill their water buckets. No one wants to be left behind. After another 3 weeks of travel, Genek finally finds himself in line at a makeshift recruiting center in Vrevskoye. A young Polish officer mans the desk. "Next," the officer calls. Genek steps forward, only two bodies separating him from his future in the Polish Second Corps. The line had wrapped twice around the small city block when he took his place that morning, but he hadn't minded. For the first time since he can remember, he is filled with a sense of purpose. Perhaps, he thinks, this was his fate all along, to fight for Poland. If anything, it's a chance for redemption, to make right the poor decision that had cost him and Hertha a year of their lives. Genek has been told nothing yet of when or where accepted recruits will report for duty. He hopes their stay in Uzbekistan won't be long. The single-room flat they've been assigned, while better than the barracks in Altenay, is hot, dirty, and teeming with rodents. He and Hertha spent their first few nights being jarred awake by the disconcerting feeling of tiny feet skittering across their chests. "There must be some kind of mistake," the recruit at the front of the line says. "I'm sorry," the officer behind the desk replies. Genek leans in to eavesdrop. "No, it has to be a mistake." "No, sir, I'm afraid it isn't." The officer shakes his head apologetically. "Anders' army isn't accepting Jews." Genek's stomach turns. "What?" "But," the man stammers, "you mean to tell me I've come all this way? But why?" Genek watches as the officer lifts a piece of paper and reads, "According to Polish law, a person of Jewish heritage belongs not to Poland, but to a Jewish nation. I'm sorry, sir." He says this without malice, but with an efficiency that suggests he's eager to move on. But what am I supposed to?
I'm sorry, sir. It isn't up to me. Next, please.
With the issue put to rest, the man slinks from the line, muttering under his breath, "No Jews in Anders' army." Genek shakes his head. He wouldn't put it past the Germans to deprive a Jew the right to fight for his country. But the Poles? If he's unable to enlist, there's no telling how he and Hertha will manage. In all likelihood, they'll be thrown back to the wolves, to a life of forced labor.
To hell with that, Genek seethes. Next, please.
A single body now separates him from the officer at the recruiting desk, from the paperwork he'll be asked to complete. He balls up his hands into fists. Beads of sweat congregate on his forehead.
That form is a deal-breaker, a voice inside declares. It's life and death. You've been here before. Think. You haven't come this far to be turned away. Next, please.
Before the man in front of him has a chance to step away from the desk, Genek pulls his cap down low over his brow and ducks quietly out of line. Weaving his way through the dry, crumbling town, his mind races. Mostly he's angry. Here he is offering up his manpower, possibly even his life, to fight for Poland. How dare his country deprive him of this right because of his religion? He wouldn't be in this whole mess in the first place if he hadn't stubbornly labeled himself Polish. He wants to yell, to punch a wall. Then his mind flashes to his year in Altenai, and he orders himself to think clearly.
I need the army, he reminds himself. It is the only way out.
He pauses at a street corner, at the entrance to a small mosque. Staring up at its stout gold dome, it hits him. Andreski. On paper, Genek and Otto Andreski have little in common. Otto is a devout Catholic, an ex-factory worker with a perpetual scowl and a chest as big as a bass drum. Genek is a lithe, dimpled Jew who has spent his career until recently behind a desk at a law firm. Otto is a brute, Genek a charmer. But despite their differences, the friendship the men forged in the forests of Siberia is a solid one. Lately, in their few moments of spare time, they have taken to throwing a set of hand-carved dice, or to playing Kierki with Genek's deck of cards, which is now in a pathetic state from overuse, but somehow still complete. Hertha and Yulia Andreski, too, have grown close, have discovered even that they competed on rival ski teams at university.
I need you to teach me to be a Roman Catholic, Genek says later that evening.
He's just finished explaining to Otto and Yulia what had happened at the recruiting center. From here on in, he announces, Hertha and I are Catholics, if anyone asks. Genek is a good student. Within days, Otto has taught him to recite Our Father and Hail Mary, to cross himself with his right hand, not his left, to rattle off the name of the reigning Pope, Pius XII, born Eugenio Maria Giuseppe Giovanni Pacelli. A week later, when Genek finally works up the courage to return to the recruiting center, he greets the young officer behind the desk with a strong handshake and a confident smile. His blue eyes are steady and his hand doesn't tremble when he prints the words Roman Catholic in the box marked religion on the recruitment form. And when his name, along with Hertha and Yusef as family members, is added to the roster as an official member of Anders' Polish Second Corps, he thanks the officer with a salute and a God bless. On the eve of their first official day as new recruits, Otto invites Genek and Hertha to his flat to celebrate. Genek brings his playing cards. They pass Otto's secret stash of vodka, sipping from a dented tin flask between hands of the agreed-upon game, Ochko. To our new Christian friends, Otto toasts, downing a swig and passing the flask to Genek.
To the Pope,
Genek adds, taking a sip and handing the tin to Hertha. To a new chapter, Hertha says, glancing at Yusef, asleep in a small basket beside her. And for a moment, The foursome is quiet as each wonders what exactly the next several months will bring.
To Anders, Yulia chirps, lightening the mood, reaching for the flask and holding it victoriously over her head.
To winning this fucking war,
Otto howls, and Genek laughs, as the prospect of winning a war being fought worlds away from Vrevskoye, a dusty Central Asian town whose name he can barely pronounce, seems as unlikely as it does absurd. The vodka makes its way again to Genek.
Nyes chestje nam sprija,
he offers, the tin raised. May luck be on our side. They are low, it seems, on good fortune, and something tells him they'll need it.
December 7th, 1941. Japan bombs Pearl Harbor. December 11th, 1941. Adolf Hitler declares war on the United States. On the same day, the United States declares war on Germany and Italy. A month later, the first American forces arrive in Europe, landing in Northern Ireland. January 20, 1942. At the Wannsee Conference in Berlin, Reich Director Reinhard Heydrich outlines a final solution plan to deport the millions of Jews remaining in German-conquered territories to extermination camps in the East.
Chapter 28. Mila and Felicia. Outside Radom, German-occupied Poland, March 1942. It's warm inside the train car, despite the cold March air whipping at their cheeks through the open window. Mila and Felicia have been standing for over an hour, packed in too tightly to sit. But the mood is bright, giddy almost with excitement. Whispers of freedom, of what it will feel like, taste like, circulate throughout the car. They are the fortunate few, the 40-odd Jews from the Wałowa ghetto, who have made the list. Doctors, dentists, lawyers. Radom's most liberal and educated professionals, selected to emigrate to America. Mila was skeptical at first. Everyone was. America had declared war on Axis powers in December. They'd sent troops to Ireland in January. Why would Hitler offer up a band of Jews to a country that had designated itself an enemy? But he'd sent a group to Palestine the month before, and despite what everyone thought, that surely the Jews had really been shipped off, not to Palestine, but to their deaths. Rumors had begun flying through the ghetto that they had made it safely to Tel Aviv. And so, when the opportunity arose, Mila was quick to put her name on the list. She believed it. This was her chance. Felicia stands with her arms wrapped around Mila's thigh, relying on her mother's balance to steady hers. What does it look like now, Mamushu? She asks. It's the same question every few minutes. She's too little to see out the window. Just trees, love. Apple trees. Pastures. Occasionally, Mila hoists her to her hip so Felicia can see. Mila has explained where they are going, but the word America has little significance in Felicia's 3.5-year-old mind. What about father? She'd asked when Mila first told her of the plan. And the sentiment had nearly broken Mila's heart. Despite having no memories of him, Felicia worried that Selim would return to Radom, only to find that she and her mother had disappeared. Mila had assured her as best she could that she would send an address as soon as they arrived in America, that Selim could meet them there, or they could return to Poland once the war was over. It's just that right now, Mila had said, staying here isn't safe. Felicia had nodded, but Mila knew it was hard for the child to make sense of it all. Mila herself had no concept, really, of what to expect. The one thing that was undeniably clear was just how dangerous it had become for Felicia in the ghetto. Hiding her in that sack of fabric scraps and then walking away was one of the hardest things Mila had ever done. She would never forget waiting outside the workshop
as the SS conducted their raid, praying that Felicia would remain still, as she'd instructed her to, praying that the Germans would pass her by, praying that she'd done the right thing in leaving her baby girl there, alone in the workshop. When the SS retreated, and Mila and the others were finally allowed to return to their desks, Mila sprinted to the wall of fabric scraps, nearly hysterical, crying hot, grateful tears as she pulled her daughter, shivering and wet, from the sack. Mila vowed that day in the workshop to find a safer place for Felicia to hide, somewhere outside the ghetto, where the SS wouldn't think to look for her. A few months ago in December, she tucked her daughter into a straw-filled mattress and held her breath as she dropped the mattress from the flat's second-story window. Their building lay on the perimeter of the ghetto. Isaac waited below. As a member of the Jewish police, he was allowed outside the ghetto walls. The plan was for him to take Felicia to the home of a Catholic family, where she could live, under their care, posing as Aryan. The terrifying two-story drop, thankfully, was a success. The mattress broke Felicia's fall, just as planned. Mila had cried into a clenched fist at the sight of Isaac leading Felicia away by the hand, as petrified of leaving her daughter in someone else's care, as she was relieved that Felicia had survived the fall. Anything had to be safer than the ghetto, though, where disease spread like wildfire, and where every day, it seemed, a Jew without the proper papers, or too old, or too sick, was discovered and killed, shot in the head, or beaten and left to die in the street for everyone to see. She'd done the right thing, Mila told herself over and over again that night, unable to sleep. The next day, however, Mila found a note from Isaac beneath the door to the flat. "Offer renounced," it read. "Returning the parcel at 22 hours." Mila would never learn what went wrong, whether the family changed their minds, or whether Felicia was deemed too Jewish-looking to pass as their own. At 10 that evening, she was returned to the ghetto, clinging white-knuckled to a rope of sheets, dangling from the same second-story window. To make matters worse, a week later, feverish and short of breath, Felicia was diagnosed with a severe case of pneumonia. Mila had never wished harder for Selim to return. Surely he would tend to their daughter more effectively than any of the doctors at Vavova's clinic could. Felicia's recovery was slow. Twice Mila thought she might lose her. In the end, it was the steam from a boiled eucalyptus branch Isaac smuggled in that finally opened up her windpipe, allowing her to breathe again and eventually to heal. A few days after Felicia was finally back on her feet, the SS announced they would send a select group of Jews from Vavova to America. And now, here they are. Mila tries to imagine what it means to be American, envisioning warm homes filled with well-stocked pantries and happy, healthy children and streets where, Jewish or not, you were free to walk and work and live, just like everyone else. Resting a hand atop Felicia's head, she watches the leafless domes of beech trees speed by through the window of the train car. It is a thrilling prospect, the idea of a new life in the States. But of course, it is also devastating, for it means leaving her family behind. Mila's throat tightens. Saying goodbye to her parents in the ghetto had nearly broken her resolve. She brings a hand to her stomach where the pain is still sharp, like a fresh stab wound. She tried hard to convince her parents to put their names on the list, but they refused. "No," they said, "they won't take a couple of old shopkeepers." "You go," they insisted. "Felicia deserves a better life than this." In her head, Mila takes inventory of her parents' valuables. They are down to 20 zloty, and they sold off most of their porcelain, silk, and silver. They have a bolt of lace, which they could barter if they needed to. And of course, there's the amethyst. Thankfully, Nahuma hasn't had to part with that yet. And better than any wealth, she has Halina now, Halina and Adam had moved back to Radom not long after Jakob and Bella arrived. They lived outside the ghetto walls with their false IDs, and with Isaac's help, they are able to sneak an egg or a couple of zloty into the ghetto every now and then. Her parents also have Jakob nearby. His plan, he told Mila before she left, was to appeal for a job at the factory outside of town where Bella worked. He would be less than 20 kilometers away and promised to check on Saul and Nehuma often. Her parents are not alone, Mila reminds herself, and that brings her some comfort. Outside, there is hissing, brakes screaming. The train slows. Mila peers out the window, surprised to see nothing but open fields on either side of the track. An odd place to stop. Perhaps there is another train meeting them, to take them the rest of the way to Krakow, where, they've been told, a group of Americans from the Red Cross will escort them to Naples. The door slides open, and she and the others are ordered to disembark. Outside the car, Mila's eyes follow the length of the tracks splayed out before them. They are empty. Her stomach flips. And just as suddenly as she realizes that something is amiss, the group is surrounded by a throng of men. She can tell right away that they are Ukrainian. Burly, dark-haired, and broad-chested, they look nothing like the fair-skinned, sharp-featured Germans who'd piled them into the train car hours earlier at the station in Radom. The Ukrainians shout orders, and Mila tightens her grip on Felicia's hand, her plight instantly and horrifically clear. Of course, how could she have been so naive? They'd volunteered for this, thinking it was their ticket to freedom. Felicia looks up at her, eyes wide, and it is all Mila can do to keep her knees from buckling. This was her decision. She'd brought this upon them. The group is arranged into two lines, marched 20 meters into the field, and handed shovels. Dig! One of the Ukrainians yells in Russian, his hands cupped around his mouth in place of a bullhorn, the metal barrel of his rifle catching the waning rays of the afternoon sun. Dig or we shoot! As the Jews begin to dig, the Ukrainians walk circles around them, their teeth bared like wild dogs, barking orders or insults over their shoulders. You with the children, one of them yells. Mila and the three others with children at their sides look up. Work faster. You dig two holes. Mila instructs Felicia to sit at her feet. She keeps her chin down with one eye always on her daughter. Every once in a while, she glances over at the others. Some are sobbing, tears rolling silently down their cheeks and onto the cold earth beneath them. Others appear dazed, their eyes glazed, defeated. No one looks up. No one talks. The only sound filling the thin March air is the scrape of steel against the cold, hard dirt. Before long, Mila's hands are cracked and bleeding, her lower back slick with sweat. She peels off her wool coat and sets it on the ground beside her. Within seconds, it is snatched up and added to a mound of clothing beside the train. The Ukrainians continue to keep a close watch, making sure that hands are moving and bodies are occupied. An officer in a captain's uniform surveys the scene from his position by the train. He appears to be German, SS. Obersturmführer, perhaps. Mila has begun to recognize the various Nazi military ranks by their insignia, but she's too far away to know for sure exactly what position this man holds. Whoever he is, it's obvious that he is calling the shots. What went through his mind, Mila wonders, when he was assigned this job? She grimaces as her weight on the shovel's wooden handle tears another coin-sized flap of flesh from her palm. Ignore it, she commands, refusing to feel the pain, refusing to feel sorry for herself. With the ground nearly frozen, her progress is slow. Fine. It'll buy her some time. A few more minutes on earth to spend with her daughter. Mamushu, Felicia whispers, tugging at Mila's slacks. She sits cross-legged at her mother's feet. Mamushu, look.
Mila follows Felicia's gaze. One of the Jews in the field has dropped his shovel and is walking toward the German by the train. Mila recognizes him as Dr. Friedman, who before the war was a prominent dentist in Radom. Selim used to see him. A couple of the Ukrainians noticed too, and cocked their rifles, aiming them in his direction. Mila holds her breath. He's going to get himself killed. But the captain motions for his subordinates to lower their weapons. Mila exhales.
What happened? Felicia whispers.
Shh, Sherry, it's okay.
Mila breathes as she presses her foot into her shovel's blade.
Be still, okay? Stay just here where I can see you. I love you, my darling girl. Just stay close to me.
Mila watches as Dr. Friedman converses with a German. He appears to be talking fast, touching his cheek. After a minute, the captain nods and points over his shoulder. Dr. Friedman bows his chin and then walks quickly to an empty train car and climbs inside.
He's been spared. But why?
In Radom, the Jews in the ghetto were always being called upon to help the Germans. Perhaps, Mila thinks, Dr. Friedman has done some dental work for the captain in the past, and the German has realized he'll need his services again.
Mila's stomach turns. She certainly hasn't done any favors. She'd be better off grabbing Felicia and running for their lives.
She glances at the tree line, but it's 200 meters beyond the tracks. No, they can't run. They'd be shot in an instant. A sharp wind whirls a cloud of dirt across the field, and Mila leans into her shovel, her eyes gritty, blinking as she contemplates her reality. No favors to be returned. Nowhere to run. They're stuck. As she wraps her mind around the inevitable, a gunshot rips through the air. She wheels her head around in time to see a man a row over from hers fall to the ground.
Had he tried to run?
Mila covers her mouth and immediately looks to Felicia.
Felicia!
But her daughter is transfixed, her eyes glued to the body lying face down on the dirt, to the blood rippling from the back of his skull.
Felicia, Mila says again.
Finally, her daughter turns. Her eyes are huge, her voice tiny.
Mamushu? Why did they?
Darling, look at me, Mila pleads. Look at me, only me. It's going to be okay.
Felicia is trembling.
But why?
I don't know, love. Come, sit closer, just by my leg here, and watch me, okay?
Felicia crawls closer to her mother's leg, and Mila reaches quickly for her hand. Felicia gives it to her, and Mila bends down quickly to kiss it.
It's okay, she whispers.
As she stands, the air is filled with yelling.
Who will be the next to run? The voices taunt. You see? You see what happens? Who's next?
Felicia stares up at her mother with tear-filled eyes, and Mila bites the insides of her cheeks to keep from unraveling.
She mustn't cry. Not now. Not in front of her daughter.
Chapter 29. Jakob and Bella.
Armee Verpflegung Lager, AWL Factory, outside Radom,
German-occupied Poland, March 1942. Jakob waves a handkerchief as he approaches the factory entrance.
Scheißen Sie nicht! Don't shoot! He pants, his breath coming and going in a staccato of short, shallow puffs.
He's jogged nearly 18 kilometers carrying his suitcase and his camera to get there, and he is terribly out of shape. The muscles in his right arm will be sore for a week, and the soles of his feet are swollen and abscessed from the journey, but he hasn't yet noticed. An SS guard rests a hand on his pistol and squints in Jakob's direction.
Don't shoot!
Jakob pleads again when he's close enough to hand the guard his ID.
Please, I'm here to see my wife. She's...
He glances at the dagger dangling by a chain from the guard's belt, and suddenly he's tongue-tied.
She's expecting me.
It comes out as one long word. The guard studies Jakob's papers. They're his real ones. In the ghetto and here at the factory, there's no point in posing as someone he's not.
From?
The guard asks, studying Jakob's ID, although it's more a statement than a question.
Radom. Age?
26.
Date of birth?
1st of February, 1916. The guard quizzes Jakob until he's certain he's the young man his papers say he is.
Where is your Ausweis?
Jakob swallows. He doesn't have one. I requested one, but please, I'm here for my wife. It's her parents. They are very sick. She has to know. Jakob wonders if the lie is as obvious as it feels on his tongue. The guard surely will see through it. Please, Jakob begs. It is dire. A film of sweat has collected on his brow. It glistens under the glare of the midday sun. The guard stares hard at him for a moment.
Stay here,
he finally grunts, pointing with his eyes at the ground before disappearing through an unmarked door. Jakob obeys. He sets his suitcase at his feet and waits, wringing his felt cap in his hands. The last time he saw Bella was 5 months ago, in October, just before she was assigned to work at the Armee Verpflegungslager factory, which everyone referred to simply as AVL. Back then, they were living with her parents in the Glinice ghetto, just down the road from the factory. Bella was still a wreck. The days were long and miserable, and there was little he could do to comfort her as she descended into the depths of despair over the loss of her sister. Jakob would never forget the day she left. He'd stood at the ghetto entrance, his fingers curled around the iron bars of the gate, watching as she was escorted to a waiting truck. Bella had turned before climbing in, her expression heavy with sorrow, and Jakob had blown her a kiss and watched, through wet eyes, as she'd brought her own hand to her lips. He couldn't tell if she'd meant to return the kiss, or if her hand was there to keep from crying. Soon after Bella left for the factory, Jakob requested to be transferred to the Vavova ghetto so he could live with his parents. He and Bella kept up by letter. Reading her words brought Jakob some peace. She'd barely spoken since Anna disappeared, but putting pen to paper, it seemed, was easier for her. At AVL, Bella said, she'd been allocated the job of mending leather boots and broken holsters from the German front. You should join me, she coaxed in her most recent letter. The foreman here is tolerable, and there is far more space in the factory barracks than there is in the ghetto. I miss you so much. Please, come. Jakob knew when he read those words, I miss you, that he would find a way to be with her. It would mean leaving his parents, but they had Halina to watch out for them. False IDs if they needed them. A small stash of potatoes, flour, and some cabbage his mother had stockpiled before winter. The amethyst. He'd be close. 18 kilometers. He could write to them. Visit if he needed to, he reasoned. There was also his job, however, and the prospect of leaving it was daunting. In the ghetto, a job was a lifeline. If you were deemed skilled enough to work, you were, for the most part, worthy of living. When the Germans discovered Jakob knew how to operate a camera, they assigned him work as a photographer. Every morning, he was allowed to exit Vavova's arched gates to take pictures of whatever it was his supervisor asked for. Weapons, armories, uniforms, sometimes even women. Every so often, his supervisor would recruit a couple of blonde Polish girls who, for a few zloty or an evening's meal, were more than willing to pose for Jakob, wearing nothing but a tattered fur kept for this purpose. When he returned at the end of the day, he would hand over his film without any idea as to who would eventually look at his photos or why. Today, however, would be different. He'd received his assignment as he always did, but he'd set off from his supervisor's office with a pocketful of Yunak cigarettes and an assignment he wouldn't complete. If he is forced to return to Vavova, his roll of film still blank, his plan will likely cost him his life. Jakob checks his watch. It's 2 in the afternoon. In 3 hours, his boss will realize he's missing. The factory door swings open and Bella appears, clad in the same navy slacks and white collared shirt she was wearing when she left. A yellow scarf covers all but a small fraction of her hairline. She smiles when she sees him, and Jakob's heart warms. A smile. "Hello, sunshine," he says. They hug quickly.
"Jakob, I didn't know you were coming," Bella says. "I know, I'm sorry, I didn't want to..."
Jakob pauses, and Bella nods, understanding. Their letters have been censored for months. It would have been foolish to write and tell her of his plans.
"I'll go talk to the foreman," Bella says, glancing over her shoulder at the guard, parked a few meters behind her. "Did your sister make it off?"
In his last letter, Jakob had told Bella of Mila's plan to move to the States.
"She left this morning," he says, "she and Felicia."
"Good. That's a relief. I'm glad you came, Kuba," Bella says. "Stay here." The guard follows her back inside, and Jakob remembers a second too late about the cigarettes. He'd meant to sneak them into Bella's palm so she could use them for a bribe. He curses himself silently, left once again to wait outside in the cold, cap in hand. Inside, Bella makes her way to the desk of the foreman, Officer Meyer, a big-boned German with a broad forehead and a thick, well-kept mustache. "My husband has come from the ghetto," she begins, deciding it best to get straight to the point. Her German is now fluent. "He is here outside. He is an excellent worker, Herr Meyer. He is in good health, very responsible." Bella pauses. Jews don't ask favors of Germans, but she has no other choice.
"Please, I beg of you, can you find him a job here at the factory?"
Meyer is a decent man. In the past 3 months, he's been good to Bella, allowed her to take her meal on Yom Kippur after nightfall, to visit her parents every so often in the Glinice ghetto, a short walk from the factory. Bella is an efficient worker, nearly twice as productive as most of the others of the factory. Perhaps this is why he treats her well. Meyer runs a thumb and forefinger over his mustache. He sizes Bella up, narrowing his eyes at her, as if searching for some ulterior motive. Bella removes the gold brooch that Jakob gave her so long ago from the chain she'd strung around her neck. "Please," she says, dropping the tiny rose with its inlaid pearl into her palm and offering it to Meyer.
"This is all I have. Take it."
Bella waits, her arm outstretched. "Please, you won't regret it." Finally, Meyer leans forward, resting his forearms on his desk, his eyes meeting hers.
"Kurz," he says in his thick German accent. "Keep it, Kurz."
He sighs, shakes his head.
"I'll do it for you, but I won't do it for anyone else."
He turns to the guard standing at attention by the door to his office.
"Go on, let him in."
Chapter 30. Mila and Felicia. Outside Radom, German-occupied Poland, March 1942. The pile of earth beside what Mila knows will be her grave has grown to half a meter high.
"Deeper!"
a Ukrainian shouts as he struts by, making his rounds. Mila's palms are caked now with blood, her entire torso drenched with sweat, despite the March cold. She takes off her sweater, drapes it over Felicia's shoulders, and wraps her scarf tightly around her right hand, the more painful of the two. Pressing the sole of her shoe to the head of her shovel, she ignores the sting and glances again toward the train tracks to survey the scene. The captain stands with his arms folded over his chest at the front of the train. A few cars down, a dozen Ukrainians appear bored as they fiddle with their caps, twirling them around their fingers, their rifles slung to their backs. Some kick the dirt. Others converse, their shoulders rocking at a remark one of the others has made.
"Barbarians."
Two more Jews have joined Dr. Friedman. Apparently they too have doled out special favors and have been spared. Clamping her jaw shut, Mila lifts another mound of dirt from the hole at her feet, pours it atop her pile.
Look, someone behind her whispers. A young blonde woman has dropped her shovel. She struts quickly toward the tracks, toward the German, her shoulders pinned back, her black overcoat cinched tightly to her waist, its tails billowing behind her. Mila's heart skips, as she is reminded of her sister Halina, the only other woman she knows with that kind of bravado. As others begin to whisper and point, one of the Ukrainians beside the train raises his rifle, aims it. The others follow suit. The young fugitive raises her palms.
"Don't shoot," she cries in Russian, picking up her pace to a trot as she approaches the men.
The Ukrainians cock their weapons and Mila holds her breath. Felicia looks too. The gunmen glance to the German, awaiting approval, but the captain tilts his chin and fixes his gaze on the petite, fearless Jew approaching. He shakes his head and says something Mila can't decipher, and the Ukrainians slowly lower their arms. Mila catches a glimpse of the young woman's profile when she reaches the tracks. She's pretty, with fine features and skin the color of porcelain. Even from afar, it's easy to see that her hair is the kind of strawberry blonde that can only be real. Peroxided hair, which was common now in the ghetto, anything to look less Jewish, was easy to spot. Mila watches as the woman gestures casually with one hand, the other resting on her hip, and says something that makes the German laugh. Mila blinks. She's won him over. Just like that. What did she offer? Sex? Money? Mila roils with a mix of disgust with the captain and jealousy of the beautiful, unflinching blonde. A perimeter guard shouts, and the Jews go silently back to their digging. Mila tries to imagine herself putting on a bold, provocative face and strutting across the meadow. But she's a mother, for goodness sake, and even when she was young, she never had Halina's talent for flirting. She'd be shot before she even reached the train. And on the chance she managed to make it to within earshot of the German, what could she possibly say to seduce him into saving her? I have nothing to... And then an idea strikes her. Her spine snaps upright.
Felicia, she whispers.
Felicia looks up, surprised by the intensity in her voice. Mila speaks softly so the others won't hear.
Watch my eyes, love. Do you see that woman over there by the train?
Mila looks toward the train car and Felicia's gaze follows. She nods. Mila's breath is shallow. She's shaking.
No time to second guess yourself. You got your daughter into this. You can at least try to get her out.
Mila kneels for a moment, pretending to pull a pebble from her shoe, so she and Felicia can see eye to eye. She speaks slowly.
I want you to run to her and pretend she's your mother.
Felicia knits her eyebrows together, confused.
When you reach her, Mila continues, hold on to her and don't let go.
No, Mamushu.
Mila brings a finger to her daughter's lips.
It's all right. You will be all right. Just do as I say.
Tears well in Felicia's eyes.
Mamushu, will you come too?
Her voice is barely audible.
No, darling, not right now. I need you to do this alone. Do you understand?
Felicia nods, her eyes lowered. Mila reaches for Felicia's chin, lifting it so their eyes meet again.
Tak?
Tak, Felicia whispers.
Mila can barely breathe, her lungs suffocated by the sadness in her daughter's eyes, by the plan that is about to unfold. She nods as bravely as she can.
If the men ask, that woman is Tvoya Mamusha, okay?
Moya Mamusha,
Felicia repeats. But the words taste strange and wrong in her mouth, like something poisonous. Mila stands and glances again at the woman by the train, who appears now to be telling a story. The German is rapt. She lifts her sweater from Felicia's shoulders.
Go now, love, she whispers, nodding toward the train.
Felicia scrambles to her feet, looking up at her, pleading with her eyes, don't make me.
Mila squats, presses